Good day. Today is Thursday, 16th July 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, the last few hours in the conflict in Ukraine have been in some ways extraordinary. I am not sure that they are momentous or even important, but they have certainly been very interesting. And they may suggest that we are indeed close to a point that many have spoken about in the past, indeed at various times over the last four years, close to the point when attrition on Ukraine has been starting to tell and is beginning to have its effect. Well, let's begin with something that happened in the sky, because last night we got two massive assaults by the Russians on two Ukrainian cities. One was Kiev, which was heavily attacked by Iskander ballistic missiles and by Iran drones. Again, no Oreshniks were used in this attack, but there were heavy attacks once again on enterprises of the Ukrainian military industrial complex. And once more, the weight of the attack, the largest part of the attack was carried out by ballistic missiles, Iskander M ballistic missiles. We're not getting exact and very reliable details, it must be said, so far, of the exact number of these missiles that were used. But it does appear to have been another extremely powerful strike, perhaps not quite as powerful as some of the strikes that took place earlier in July, but closer to those big strikes from July in scale than the later strikes that we have seen over the course of mid-July. And, well, the Russian Defense Ministry again tell us that the primary target was industrial enterprises that appear to be involved in some form and in some way in Ukraine's missile and drone program. Now, the interesting fact about this very powerful strike is that it took place as various Western dignitaries were arriving in Kiev. The European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, was one of them. Other dignitaries were heads of government and heads of state from various southeastern European states, Balkan states. President Vucic of Serbia was one of them, interestingly. So was the president of Romania, and I believe that other leaders from southeastern Europe were there as well. Apparently, this is all part of some major discussion about the situation in southeastern Europe. And I understand that the Prime Minister of Moldova, Maria Sandu, was there as well. Now, I'm not going to discuss this meeting or what happened over the course of this meeting, because there have been any number of meetings between the Ukrainians, Zelensky, and European dignitaries and Western dignitaries. And the one thing that is common to all of these meetings is that there is a great deal of discussion, many flowery declarations, statements of intent, occasionally even contracts signed. In this case, there was further contracts signed between Ursula and Zelensky, apparently, for the production of more weapons, drones, I believe, in Europe for Ukraine and all that kind of thing. But these meetings, these contracts, these statements, these declarations really ultimately amount to very little. Another important Western official also went to Kiev at roughly this time. I say important, though you could argue that he is now important in title only, and that is Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of Britain. He went to Ukraine. Apparently he went there directly after he attended his last Prime Minister's questions in the Parliament in Westminster. He, of course, has been a regular visitor to Ukraine. He has been an intense, even passionate friend of Volodymyr Zelensky. Alex Cristoforo and I have joked about the way in which Keir Starmer has embraced Zelensky and the Zelensky curse, which has indeed led to his fall from power. But anyway, there he was back in Kiev, meeting Zelensky, hugging Zelensky, telling Zelensky that Ukraine is in safe hands. Britain will continue to stand by Ukraine once he is gone, all that sort of thing. Very typical of Keir Starmer, and incidentally very typical of Keir Starmer, that he, almost the last important act he makes as Prime Minister, is to travel to Kiev to meet Zelensky. After all, he has been far more interested and engaged in supporting Zelensky and Ukraine in the 2 years that he has been Prime Minister than in governing Britain itself, or so at least it seems to me. Anyway, all of these Western leaders were there, and yet, and very unusually, the Russians carried on with their big drone and missile strikes. In the past, the Russians have tended to hold back from big drone and missile strikes on Kiev when senior Western leaders and Western officials are in Kiev. Now, the drone and missile strikes that the Russians carried out on Defense Ministry enterprises last night were located in Kiev's outskirts, not close to the building in Bankova where these Western dignitaries would have been at various times received by Zelensky. So you could say that these Western dignitaries were never at any point in any serious danger. But still, the Russians, after all, back in May, began to give warnings that Kiev was becoming unsafe for Western officials. They gave advice to Western embassies to quit Kiev. The embassies have not followed that advice. Now we see that the Russians are happy to conduct strikes on Kiev even whilst Western officials are in the city. They're not, in other words, quite as punctilious about protecting the safety of Western visitors to Kiev as they once were. And just for the record, I suspect that as the summer and autumn continues, we will start to see Russian strikes move closer and closer to the centre of Kiev, and eventually the Oreshniks will be used. And at that point, Kiev is going to become very unsafe for Western officials indeed. Anyway, that's one major attack that the Russians carried out last night. But the attack that perhaps is attracting the greatest attention was a massive Russian attack that took place on Odessa and on the port of Odessa and on ships that are attempting either to dock or to leave Odessa, or which are in fact docked at the various ports that make up the Odessa port complex. And this was a huge strike. And interestingly and importantly, it also involved Tupolev 22 M3 medium-range backfire bombers that took off from the Russian airbase at Engels near the city of Saratov. And these bombers, apparently there were four of them in total, some say two, but anyway, there was a significant number of them. Anyway, they then patrolled over the Black Sea and launched their KH-22 or KH-32 missiles towards Odessa from their launch points over the Black Sea. And the KH-22, I actually think they're more likely KH-32s. It's a missile that is identical to the KH-22 in external appearance, though it uses a different motor, a different engine, different guidance systems, and a different warhead. Anyway, these missiles are simply enormous. They are very powerful. And Ukraine in the past has admitted that it can't intercept them, even when it had Patriot missiles. Though I remember that eventually, no doubt under intense political pressure, the Ukrainian air defense did start to make claims that they had managed to shoot down one or two. These missiles, which are huge, were originally designed by the Soviet Union in the 1960s, though they entered service in the 1970s, and were specifically designed to be launched by the Tupolev 22s, backfire bombers. And they were specifically designed to destroy US Navy carriers. In fact, they are the primary weapon system to this day that the Russians use to destroy, in the event of an all-out war, US Navy carriers. And in order to do that, they are enormous missiles. They are long-range missiles. Their way of operating is that they, after launch from the bomber aircraft, they climb to the upper limits of the atmosphere, and then they carry out a diving attack, almost vertical attack, at very high supersonic speeds on the target, which would notionally be an aircraft carrier, but it can be a ground target too. The explosive of the warhead is enormous, and the impact of one of these things, if they hit the target, is absolutely devastating. It may be the single most devastating weapon, other than the Oreshnik itself, that the Russians have used at various points during the conflict in Ukraine. And, well, from what we can tell, again, the target was harbour installations in Odessa itself. And it wasn't, of course, just these KH-32 missiles that were used against targets in Odessa, but other missiles as well, though again it's not easy to obtain exact details, and large numbers of Gerand drones. Mostly now, and I believe this is true of Kiev as well, these Gerand 4 jet-powered optically guided drones. And again, the damage was enormous, and there's pictures of ships, merchant ships in the port of Odessa, which have been destroyed. And here we can actually talk about actual destruction as opposed to damage. As I've discussed again in many programs, many of the pictures that we have seen of ships damaged by Ukrainian drone attacks in the Sea of Azov, in fact, all of the pictures I have seen, show damage rather than outright destruction. But in this case, it does seem as if what we have is outright destruction. Now, the Russians have been operating a virtual blockade of Odessa, in my opinion, for about a year. But it has nonetheless been possible for some ships to enter and leave Odessa during that period. Mostly they do so by hugging the coastline. Odessa itself is located quite close to Romania. So ships that leave Odessa hug the Ukrainian coastline for a short distance until they enter Romanian waters, where up to now the Russians have not attacked them. That, by the way, may also change. But following these attacks, it would be a very, very reckless ship owner and captain who was prepared to send ships to Odessa. Odessa, as a port, is now in effect non-functional. And that means that Ukraine, in effect, has no port on its Black Sea coast, because there are some smaller ports on the Black Sea still controlled by Ukraine. Mostly they are very close to Crimea and therefore vulnerable, and they are too small to service large merchant ships. Now, that doesn't mean that Ukraine is totally cut off from the sea. What the Ukrainians could in theory do, what perhaps they are doing, is sending cargoes that they used to transport from Odessa by sea to the Romanian port of Constanza, and perhaps they also import goods by sea from Constanza. And I wouldn't be surprised that that is one of the topics of the discussions between the Western officials and Zelensky. The Western officials, who of course include the current president of Romania, which have been taking place in Kiev. However, using Constanza is going to add time and complexity to the export of and import of goods. It also obliges Ukraine to use its railway system, and the railway system itself is becoming more vulnerable. And of course, it also means that Odessa itself is becoming more threatened and vulnerable as well. In my program yesterday, I said that many of these attacks that the Russians are now carrying out on Odessa, and the one last night was the biggest, but many of the attacks now for several weeks, in fact, have been very big. Anyway, they all seem to me to be preparing the ground eventually for some kind of Russian operation to capture Odessa eventually. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, rumours have been circulating in Russia that General Surovikin is now back in favour, and that he might be the officer that is going to be assigned the task of taking the Russian army across the Dnieper into western Ukraine and eventually capturing Odessa. Now, I had a very interesting explanation of General Surovikin's background from a contact who, by the way, I would stress, is in the West and who's provided me information, which, well, you can, I'm not going to discuss how he obtained this information, but this source has been consistently reliable. Anyway, what this person tells me is that Surovikin's background is not very well understood in the West, that yes, he was for a time overall commander of Russia's aerospace forces. It was he who launched the Russian missile offensive against Ukraine in October 2022, at the same time as he was overall ground force commander of Russian forces in Ukraine for a few months. But ultimately, his background is as a special forces commander. In fact, he is a general in the Russian special forces, as well as being a general, separately a general in Russia's conventional forces. And amongst his various tasks, he was also the officer who was supervising the Wagner organization, which partly explains why he ran into political difficulties in the summer of 2023, because there was a feeling in Russia that he had not managed to keep Prigozhin and the Wagner organization under control, though this source has provided me now with very significant information about Suravikin's key role in suppressing the Wagner mutiny. Anyway, the point is that Suravikin has never been in any real disfavor. His reassignment to Africa was part of his normal duties. And if he is coming back, it is because, as a special forces officer, he was the officer who essentially developed the system of infiltrating cities in order to capture them, which the Russians have been applying so successfully in various sieges, like the ones in Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka, which we have seen play out over the last year or so. So Suravikin might be the obvious person to put in command of a Russian force tasked with capturing cities like Zaporozhye, Kherson, perhaps Nikopol and Kryvyi Rog, and of course, ultimately, Odessa itself. The Russians would not want to devastate Odessa, a beautiful 19th century city with exceptionally fine architecture, which is of enormous cultural importance for the Russians. So if Suravikin knows some means to capture cities via infiltration that avoid utter devastation, then he is the obvious person to put in charge. Anyway, these things took place over the course of last night. But in the morning, something very dramatic happened, though it was already discussed in advance by me in my program yesterday, and I pointed out that there'd already been a long article in Events in Ukraine, the Substack site, and in the Financial Times that warned us or informed us that this event was about to happen. And this was the dismissal by President Zelensky of Ukraine's Defense Minister, Mykhailo Fedorov, who has been in post for just 6 months. And Mykhailo Fedorov, who is 35 and has no military background at all, has been credited by his very considerable fan club in Kiev, made up mostly of the most westernized Ukrainians, just saying, but also his very considerable fan club in the West and the various tech companies in the West that he has got extremely close to. Anyway, they've all touted him as a strategic genius. He supposedly is the man who came up and put together the genius drone war, which supposedly over the last few months has had the Russians on the ropes. The drone war, which disrupted Russian logistics on the Novorossiya Highway, that attacked Crimea and for a time caused severe fuel shortages there, that carried out strikes against Moscow and strikes against other Russian cities, that carried out strikes on targets in Donbass. One of those strikes, by the way, would have been the strike that killed all those young people in the dormitory in Starobelsk. But of course, Western commentary doesn't want to talk about that. But anyway, Fedorov is the person who is credited with being the genius behind all of this. And if you've been following the Western media as closely as I have been over the last few weeks, you will have read lots of breathless articles about Ukraine's drone revolution, how drone warfare, drone walls have supposedly fought the Russians to a standstill on the battlefronts and have inflicted serious hurt on the Russian domestic economy and allegedly brought the war home to the Russian people. Now, if you've been following these programs, you will know that I have been a consistent skeptic of every part of this narrative. It has seemed to me that far from the drones having stopped the Russians in their tracks in Donbass, or indeed anywhere in Zaporozhye at all, or in northern Ukraine, or anywhere else, the Russians, on the contrary, have been remorselessly and steadily advancing. And you will also know that I have been far more skeptical about the effectiveness of this drone offensive that the Ukrainians have been conducting against Russia altogether. There was a big drone strike on Moscow over a month ago now, when there were lots of pictures of plumes of smoke and talk about a big refinery having been hit. I said that almost certainly this greatly overstated the reality of what had actually been achieved. Subsequently, information bore that out. I've been told that the city remained calm through the entirety of this attack, that there was some panic buying of gasoline in the immediate aftermath of it. But I've also been told that the gasoline situation in Moscow is stable and that there is now overall a abundance of diesel and no shortages of this fuel at all. Since that big attack, the Ukrainians have launched one swarm of drones after another towards Moscow, and the big story is that none of them have got through. In every case, the drones and sometimes the missiles that are interspersed with the drones have been shot down some distance from Moscow. The Russian air defense around Moscow has been working extremely effectively, and the life of the city has gone by almost unaffected. There have also been drone strikes on St. Petersburg, almost certainly carried out using the airspace of the Baltic states. But again, the actual damage done to St. Petersburg has been slight. There have been attacks on various refineries around Russia. There, the damage has been more significant, as the Russian authorities have wisely admitted. However, as the Russian authorities have also said, The major reason for energy shortages, for fuel shortages in Russia, has been panic buying, to some extent triggered by these strikes, rather than an actual shortage of fuel itself. And over the last few weeks, the Russian authorities have been taking steps to bring the situation on the domestic fuel market back under control, and they appear to have been having some success. Ukrainian attacks on Russian refineries continue, but my sense is that the number of these attacks has been reducing as the air defenses around the refineries gradually harden. The Ukrainians have also been conducting a major drone offensive against shipping in the Sea of Azov. This has mostly affected, apparently, grain ships. Again, there is no doubt that large numbers of ships have been hit by drones. How much damage has actually been done, however, it is still difficult to say. And unlike Ukraine, Russia has many ports. It can redirect exports of grain and of other products through those ports. And overall, the Russian economy has been mostly unaffected. So, Fedorov, his great drone offensive, in my opinion, has been very far from being the total success that far too many people in the West have chosen to believe. It bewilders me that 4.5 years since the start of the special military operation, after so many stories and fantasies, after the ghost of Kiev, the heroic defense of Snake Island, the redeployment of Ukrainian forces in Mariupol, the claims that Bakhmut was still under Ukrainian control and that the Russian forces had been surrounded there after Bakhmut had fallen, the claims, the many claims of Ukrainian breakthroughs during the summer 2023 offensive. And well, you can go on and on. It baffles me that after all of this, all it takes is some video film of smoke over refineries to persuade people that there is a serious crisis playing out in Russia. But anyway, there it is. That is the reality. Now, some people in Ukraine have not been fooled by any of this. And all of the indications are that they have been getting increasingly angry. And those people are the people who are actually having to fight the Russians on the front lines. Even as the narrative of success has been spread across the West and in Ukraine itself, the reality on the front lines has been getting worse and worse for Ukraine practically every day. We've had the fall of Konstantinovka. We've had the Russian advances near Sumy and Kharkiv. We've had the Russian push towards Orekhov. We've had the Russian push towards Dobrupilia. We've had Russian advances almost in every place, and clear indications that the fall of Donbass is now only a short time away. Now, as it happens, this morning, the Russian Defense Ministry posted a statement that says that Liman, the city that the Russians refer to as Krasny Liman, has fallen. It's a very curious statement, and I'm going to read it in full. It appears on the Russian Defense Ministry's Telegram channel, and it reads as follows. The deputy commander of the 9th Engineer Regiment, 25th Combined Arms Army, West Group of Forces, with the call sign Gagarin, told about operations of drones of his unit near Krasny Liman. Krasny Liman is, of course, Liman. The Russians refer to it by its old Soviet name, which is Krasny Liman, which, of course, means Red Liman. And then we have a direct quote from this officer. By the successful analysis of the enemy movement and skillful actions of teams, we are already entering enemy rear areas. The enemy has withdrawn from Krasny Liman. We control this territory. Those words, the enemy has withdrawn from Krasny Liman, we control this territory, have been highlighted by the Russian Defense Ministry. And then he's quoted, further quoted as saying, we are not limited by Krasny Liman. The Seversky Donets River is under our control. All cable crossings are mined daily. Well, I'm not going to discuss the last part of that. The point is, here we have a Russian officer on the ground being quoted by the Russian Defense Ministry. And he is saying that Liman has now fallen, that the Russians have actually captured Liman. Now, the Russians today are also saying that they are very close to starting the operation against Orekhov. And this comes from TASS, and it is from our old friend Igor Kimakovsky. He is quoted by TASS as saying, regarding the whole territory, we're about to gain ground in several areas. It's Battle Group East, the Guliapolia direction. Our troops are moving along the second defence line set by the enemy. It's Novoselovka, Chudesknoye, and the Verkhnaya Tersa area. We are breaking through the first defence line in the Zaporozhye region that covers Orekhovo, so that we can now outflank it. And he says that the Russians have closely approached the Ukrainian defence line near the Verkhnaya Tersa settlement. So he is talking about a potential Russian breakthrough in Orekhov on the eastern side of Orekhov. And incidentally, there are also reports that a Russian counteroffensive in western Zaporozhye region is now also gaining traction as well, and that the Russians are pushing the Ukrainians back west of Orekhov as well. Now, all of this is happening for many reasons, but one of the reasons, a key reason, is that Ukraine does not have enough infantry to hold positions. This has been a consistent complaint from Ukrainian commanders, Ukrainian soldiers, Ukrainian reporting sites, and Telegram channels. And the Ukrainian military have become obviously increasingly exasperated by this. They see the solution to this problem through an increase of conscription. They have been demanding, in fact, they've been demanding since about 2023, a big increase in conscription in order to fill the gaps in the front line. Zelensky himself has been willing to accommodate them to a very great degree. We see many pictures and have seen many pictures over the last 2 years of the brutality of Ukrainian recruitment officers seizing men off the streets to bundle them off to the front lines. But there are still categories of men in Ukraine who remain off limits to these recruiters. And this, incidentally, has intensified some anger within Ukrainian society, where there is a sense that far from everyone is carrying the burden of the battle. And of course, it is causing ever greater anger within the army, who sense that the defense minister, Mikhailo Fedorov, is completely uninterested in this question, is not interested in what is actually taking place on the front lines, is not interested in the shortage of infantry, is not interested in increasing recruitment within Ukraine, but instead has retreated into the world of imagery and illusion. His drone war against Russia, which objectively is achieving very little, and his mirage, his mythology about the drone war, which supposedly is holding back the Russian army, even as in reality it is still advancing. And, well, unsurprisingly, all of this has now escalated into an outright crisis. And there was apparently a major confrontation between General Sirsky and General Gnatov, the chief of the Ukrainian general staff, and Zelensky. And Sirsky demanded, in fact, appears to have given Zelensky some kind of ultimatum, to have Fedorov sacked. We don't know what the full exact terms of this ultimatum was. But anyway, Zelensky, who has been dithering apparently for weeks over this issue, confronted by this demand, faced by this ultimatum from the military, finally took the decision late last night to sack Fedorov. And Fedorov has been sacked. He, of course, is pretending that he resigned. Some of his associates in the Ukrainian Air Force command, who are, of course, not really an Air Force command so much as a drone war operation, they resigned in sympathy. And Fedorov, as I said already, has been the hero of many people, both in Ukraine and the West. And these people, who are the sort of people who, well, you might call them, I call them, the NGO crowd, predictably, they've come out on the streets today to protest against Fedorov's sacking. And there's been more protests in Ukraine. And there's also been protests in places like the Financial Times as well. The Financial Times has written a truly remarkable editorial, Ukraine's self-defeating reshuffle. The sacking of the defense minister is a setback for the country's military efforts. And we are told about what a complete genius Fedorov was and his enormous success. We're told that Fedorov has probably been the most successful Ukrainian minister of the past 4.5 years. The 35-year-old tech whiz kid. I'm not sure that he is even that, by the way. I don't know very much his background, but my understanding is that his skill previously has been in public relations, has helped transform Ukraine's fortunes on the battlefield. As digital minister, he was the architect of Ukraine's drone revolution. He's genius. That's the Financial Times word, by the way, to describe him, not mine. His genius was encouraging a tech ecosystem that has become the envy of the world with its rapid innovation and adaption cycles. This is absolute nonsense, incidentally. As Alex Christoforou and I pointed out in a program that we did on the Duran about 3 weeks ago, the whole narrative about Ukraine's brilliant drone industry is a fantasy. And as that article in the Financial Times, which I briefly discussed yesterday, also confirmed, and we also said this 3 weeks ago, the reality about Ukrainian drones is that they're not Ukrainian made. They're not even European made, actually. They are made in China. They are screwed together from Chinese drone components exported by Chinese drone manufacturers to various third countries, Malaysia being the most important. There they are bought by European and Ukrainian contractors. They're brought to Europe. They're screwed together, mostly in Europe. They're then transported from Europe, mostly by train, to Kiev. And the Ukrainians do a few finishing touches, and there's a pretense that they are Ukrainian in some way. What they do have is terminals that are probably of ultimately American manufacture, which enable them to receive signals from the American Starlink system. But essentially, if we're talking about the long-range drones that are hitting inside Russia, these are essentially Chinese drones. They always have been. The article in the Financial Times yesterday, which said that Zelensky has now been given permission to spend 6 billion euros of the 90 billion euro loan that the Europeans are giving him to buy Chinese components directly. That Financial Times article is simply admitting to a practice that already exists and which has existed for months, if not years. If you believe that the West and the Ukrainians have not been buying Chinese drone components before now, well, all I can say is, then I absolutely do have not just one bridge, but several very fine bridges to sell you. Anyway, there we are. So the Financial Times tells us what an extraordinary, exceptional genius Fedorov is. But then we go on to read. Fedorov is being removed, seemingly for the wrong reasons. True, he has not solved the army's mobilization problems. Too few Ukrainians want to serve. Those who already do are exhausted and thinly stretched. And then there are some words in this editorial which I find chilling. The answer lies in more compulsion. Yes, the Financial Times has written that, but that is unpopular and socially destabilizing. Zelensky has not wanted to grasp the nettle. So the Financial Times wants more compulsion to recruit more troops into the Ukrainian army. It admits that Fedorov has been unable to solve not the army's mobilization problems, but the army's critical shortage of manpower, which has left the army exhausted and thinly stretched. Those, again, are the words of the Financial Times in an editorial. And its solution is more compulsion. But the blame for this lies apparently not with Fedorov, who, after all, is only Ukraine's defense minister, but with Zelensky himself, who seemingly has not wanted to grasp the nettle. In other words, who has not wanted to engage in that additional compulsion. Well, what we now know about the reshuffle that is taking place in Kiev tells us that the military are demanding that this additional compulsion be used. Almost certainly, the ultimatum that they have given Zelensky is that the army cannot hold the front line for much longer if more men are not recruited to the war. If the pressure on the Ukrainian population to recruit soldiers is not increased by orders of magnitude. If, in other words, more Ukrainian men, probably younger men, men between the ages of 18 and 25, are not also sent to the slaughter. And the man who was apparently, who has apparently, been earmarked to take Fedorov's job is apparently a man called Klimenko. He is a police official. The word is that he is actually the head of Ukraine's police. He is, in other words, a law enforcement officer. It's not difficult to work out what this is about. He is being brought in order to toughen the recruitment process, the mobilization process, to force more Ukrainian men, unwilling Ukrainian men, to go to their deaths in the killing fields of Donbass and eastern Ukraine. So this is ultimately what this is all about. I am going to venture a guess here. It is ultimately a guess because, of course, none of these people speak to me. But I am going to venture a guess that the key moment, the moment when the military's patience broke, was following the fall of Konstantinovka. The fall of Konstantinovka for Ukraine is a military disaster. It means that the entire defense line in eastern Donbass, in western Donbass, the line of fortified cities, is becoming unstable and perhaps untenable. That the days of the fall of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk are approaching. And the military, almost certainly, in fact, undoubtedly, are blaming manpower shortages for Konstantinovka's fall. And, of course, they've seen all of Fedorov's pictures of ships being hit in the Sea of Azov, of smoke over the refineries in Omsk and elsewhere. They've seen the pictures of the smoke over Moscow from about a month ago. But they say, what difference ultimately is any of this making? We are losing the war. Well, there it is. That's where we are today. So Zelensky, faced with this ultimatum, took the very, very difficult decision to sack Fedorov. The fantasy, the drones by themselves can stop the Russian army, is coming to an end. The narrative that the West, the Ukrainians, have been clinging to for the last few months about the success of Ukraine's drone efforts, the drone revolution, all of that, that's now reaching its point of crisis. And Zelensky has been forced to sack this brilliant PR guy, the man who told us about the drones and told us how drones by themselves could hold back the Russians. He's been forced to sack him and to bring in a tough police officer to go out and establish dragnets across Ukrainian cities and to round Ukrainians up and, as I said, send them to the slaughter on the killing fields of eastern Ukraine. Notice that none of these people seem prepared to do the obvious thing, the only humane thing, nor, by the way, importantly, is the Financial Times. Nowhere is it suggested that negotiations with the Russians begin, that it might be a good idea now to contact Putin and see whether Istanbul Plus, the proposals that Putin made to the foreign ministry back on the 14th of June 2024, are still stand, whether the Russians can be persuaded to stop at Donbass, or perhaps to stop at Donbass and Zaporozhye and Kherson, whether Ukraine might be willing to reconsider its irreversible course towards NATO, what Mark Rutte and Zelensky and Keir Starmer always harp on about, and reconsider whether neutral status might be a more humane and realistic option for Ukraine. Well, there is none of that. No one in Ukraine, no one in the West, at least no one of any importance, are considering these obvious possibilities. The choice the Ukrainians are being given instead is between Fedorov and his mostly ineffectual drones, and Sirsky's and Gnatov's and that of the military command. More men to be thrown, as I said, into battle and to die, ultimately, to no purpose. Before I leave this whole topic and move on from this discussion, I would say that there is a particularly gratuitous point in this article, in this editorial by the Financial Times. It talks about how Fedorov annoyed, irked, this is the words, a still Soviet-minded top brass with his modernizing startup ways, even though innovation and disruption have proved their value in this war. The only Ukrainian command officer, if I suspect probably the only officer in the Ukrainian military who actually does have a Soviet background, is of course Sirsky. And he, to be clear, only went through the first course of a Soviet officer. He went to the first level of Soviet officer school. He never went to the higher command schools as the Russian officers have done. All of the other important Ukrainian officers that I know of are Western trained. But of course, the Financial Times likes to say that they're Soviet, that they have a Soviet mentality, that they think in the Soviet way. Well, as I said, that is simply not true. It is always amazing to me how in the West we always retreat back into these fictions, which tell us ultimately far more about ourselves than they do about the real facts in the war as it is actually currently playing out. Now, before I finish this discussion, just a few more things. Firstly, Zelensky has ordered Fedorov's sacking. It doesn't mean that we've seen the end of Fedorov. I don't know whether these protests will grow. I don't know how much support within Ukrainian society they have. But my guess is that they will have a great deal of support. And the reason they will have a great deal of support, even from people in Ukraine who don't particularly like Fedorov and don't think much of his Western ways, just to say, the very things that attract the Financial Times and the Americans to him might not play so well amongst the workers and farmers and people of that kind across Ukraine who make up what's left of the bulk of Ukraine's population. But they might not be happy with these developments, and it's not impossible that they will join the protests or they will signal their support for these protests. And that Zelensky, who is mostly focused on his own preservation as president of Ukraine, will back down and will reappoint Fedorov to his post. In which case, I presume that he will have to sack Sirsky and Gnatov. And as apparently he told Senator Richard Blumenthal a few weeks ago, appoint Budanov in Sirsky's place, though Budanov, to repeat again, has absolutely no background in higher command whatsoever, seems on the face of it totally unqualified to command the Ukrainian army in this kind of war. But anyway, I can quite easily imagine Zelensky doing this if the protests gain critical mass. And of course, there is one overwhelmingly simple reason why they might indeed acquire critical mass. And that is that most Ukrainians, unlike many Westerners, probably understand the choice. They will not want someone like Klimenko to be put in charge of the defense ministry and to send out the police and the military to round up more men on the streets of Ukraine and send them off to fight on the battlefronts. Much of Ukraine's male population, as the Financial Times admits, do not want to go and fight and die. And they will understand that Fedorov's dismissal and Klimenko's appointment, if it sticks, will lead to exactly that outcome. Probably some of these people even believe the stories about the effectiveness of the drones. After all, they've been given no public evidence of the opposite, and it's comforting to think that the drones are holding back the Russians, because of course that reduces the need, the necessity of a further mobilization. So it could be that the protests will escalate, and if so, it might be that Zelensky is forced to reverse this decision that he has made. In which case, however, the military, the people who are actually fighting, are going to become further angry and more demoralized, and Ukraine's manpower problems on the front lines will simply continue and get worse. And the collapse on the front lines, which is what I suspect Sirsky and Gnatov are now warning Zelensky about, will inevitably come. So anyway, we will see how this goes. Now, in the meantime, the United States, just to finish this program, the US Senate is hesitatingly moving forward with Lindsey Graham's, the late Lindsey Graham's, bone-crushing sanctions bill against, well, in theory, the Russians, but against anybody who buys Russian oil or energy products, which, by the way, include uranium. There has been a furious statement about this from China. The Chinese have said that they will not recognize this bill, and they will this law, if it comes into effect, and they are giving strong warnings of retaliatory action if it is ever put into effect. China, a few months ago, as I discussed at the time, made it clear that it is not prepared any longer to abide by US sanctions legislation on energy issues. And it's not difficult to understand what the Chinese are going to do. I discussed in my program yesterday how the Chinese have created a licensing system which makes it increasingly difficult for Western companies to buy rare earths and to give, and obliges them to give promises that any rare earths they receive will not be provided, will not end up being used by the West's, by the US's military industrial complex. The Chinese will probably go one whole step further, and they will stop exports of rare earths. At a time when we already have an energy shock coming, it's not difficult to imagine what the effect of that on the West is going to be. There are reports that since Senator Graham's death, President Trump has turned against this sanctions, bone-crushing sanctions bill, in which case the probability is that it will fail. Of course, Zelensky has been one of the great advocates of this bill. If it is finally and conclusively thrown into the dustbin, then for Zelensky himself, it will be a profoundly demoralizing moment. Well, a couple of days ago, I spoke about how Zelensky's reshuffle, which it is now clear was a reshuffle intended to mask the real question, which is the sacking of Fedorov, gave every impression of having been arranged in haste. It was incomplete by the time Zelensky went to Paris for Bastille Day, and it gave every sign of panic. We can now see the reasons for the panic. Zelensky presented with an ultimatum by the Ukrainian military. There's never been a moment quite like that in the war up to now. An ultimatum about a likely defeat in the war, because that, it seems to me, is the only logical explanation. Of course, Zelensky was panicking. His moves, his actions, tell us as much. And we can now see why. Well, this is where I end today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.